Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Tim, and this is Get On Board,
a podcast about games worth playing. So this episode, we're going to be talking about first impressions of games, and we're calling it You Had Me at Hello. We're going to be looking at games that we loved from the very first moment that we opened the box, and we still love them. And then we're going to look at some of the games where maybe we got a really glitzy, good first impression, but as we played the game, we just did not enjoy it as much as we thought we were going to. And we'll also be talking a little bit about some of our processes and ways that we research games and discover whether they're things that we might enjoy or not.
Now, I think it's important to note that first impressions are often, for us anyway, with games, first impressions are not always truly first impressions without any kind of outside input or prior input. Very often for us, Andrew, you and I are the ones bringing the games to our game group. We've had to do some research.
Right.
We've looked at other reviews on the games. And so we're not bringing the game to the group in a completely unknown fashion. It's very rare that I will do a full impulse purchase on a game, so I open it and know little to nothing about it, or that I'm in a setting where somebody's introducing a brand new game to me that I've never even seen or heard about before.
Right.
So there are things that load those first impressions. And for me, those things are often kind of my own expectations of the game. I'm thinking, is this going to be that worker placement game that really fires this other game for me? Or, hey, I'm really drawn in by its sci-fi theme. Will I feel it that strongly? So, you know, on your end, do you have some of those things? I mean, what would you say feeds into some of those impressions?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm always looking for that perfect Dudes on a Map game. I still have not found it. So anytime I see a game that even is close to that, I'm, you know, my antenna perk up and I am on the hunt for that ideal game. But I think, you know, we know ourselves and we know what we like and appreciate. And so you can see a game that kind of picks at your senses in a good way. Maybe it's the look of it. Maybe it's a mechanic that you especially appreciate. Maybe it's a designer. I would say that I approach board gaming or my browsing and discovery process, it's a lot like online dating. You know, you see the pretty pictures, you read a catchy bio, and you have a little bit of information going into it. It's not a blind date. You're still taking a leap of faith when you actually open the box, but you've done your due diligence.
Yeah, there is kind of another factor, which I think neither of us would like to fully admit. We like to think of ourselves as very logical people, sort of above this kind of influence. But the fact of the matter is, there have been times I've ridden the hype train. I mean, gaming is about having fun, and sometimes the fun of an experience can begin with that Kickstarter pledge and sort of that expectation of, will this game, you know, this game could be that game that really lives up to its expectations. Although I have to admit that after so many Kickstarters, you do eventually kind of get jaded. But legitimately, there are times I've ridden the hype train.
I think I'm a little less prone to that than you are. For one thing, I have a smaller game collection, but I think where I can get sucked in a lot of the time is a reviewer that I especially admire, or where our tastes match up really well. I can pick up a game from that reviewer has recommended, and then later maybe that hype doesn't bear out. But I can't think of that many games where I've been pumped about them solely because they're really hot right now. I mean, not much springs to mind besides maybe Concordia and Scythe would be two recent examples where I've subscribed to the hype and it's been justified, spoiler alert. But yeah, I don't know. I try very hard to resist the hype train.
Yeah. Well, hey, let's get started with our first category, games that had me at hello and still have me. I'll lead this one off. I missed the Kickstarter on Zaya. I saw it late after it was too late to pledge. And I'd seen some of the negative reviews that some people had about that game, accusing it of being a roll-and-move game, saying that it had some unpolished elements to it. There was something about the open universe, though, in Scythe. I am a sci-fi fan, and there was something about that universe that just really drew me in. And when I got the box and I opened it, and those beautiful pre-painted ships on stands and the metal coins, and then just sort of like Tetris style building up your ship, and the options you had to either go marauding or completing missions or mining and delivering and building up an economy, all of that just seemed so exciting to me. And it still is. I love that game. Every single game. That is one of the few games I can truly tag the word epic to.
Absolutely.
That it just brings about an epic game experience every time I play it. And that would be my number one pick in this category. Now, we're not technically ranking them, but that would be my highest.
Sure. And spoiler alert, if you listen to our previous episode about board game experiences, there's a lot of crossover here, because I find that for me, a lot of the games that I'm drawn to are those ones that have sucked me into stories. So at least for me, there's a lot of games that I feel like I've already talked about last week, but I'll talk about them again because I still love them. My opinion hasn't changed in a week. For me, I've got two tiers of games in this category, because I have one game where my experience with it and my first impression of it was absolutely unsurpassed. And I haven't found another game that's affected me quite like this one. This is my number one game of all time, Glory to Rome.
Oh, yeah.
From the very first minute I saw the art that Heiko Günther has done for this game, I know the black box can be polarizing, but for me, from the very first minute I saw it, I had to have it. And when I got it and I opened it, I was reading the rule book. I was reading it with you, actually. And I remember I just stopped midway through. I said, I've got tingles going up my back because this game is so innovative. I just know I'm going to love it. And 40 plays later, that has totally worn out. That is still my number one game of all time. I love the depth that's there. And I knew as soon as I saw it that that was a phenomenal game that I had to have, no matter what the cost. It was the very first Grail game that I've ever come across, and it's so far the best one. I have not found a better game than Glory to Rome. So that for me was a game where that first impression, that gotta have it feeling, has been totally justified, and we've gotten our money's worth out of those cards.
Yeah, you know, I don't really understand the criticism of the Black Box edition. I know it's a matter of taste. I just felt the original Glory to Rome, the artwork on it, was just almost cheap in the game.
I don't think people who dislike the black box necessarily prefer the original artwork. I think their criticism was just that the black box took things too far in the other direction. It's too stark, too minimalist. But for me, I love that. Yeah, and Heiko made some really good graphic design optimizations that just make the cards. It's hard to design a multi-use card that is really effective. He did a really good job with it.
Yeah.
And if you compare it to some of the European editions where they had a whole team of designers working on that and different artwork, sure, it's a different style, but you can see that his work is at least high quality, even if it's not your taste.
Yeah.
Personally, I love it. I have no complaints with it. It's been worth every penny. But
well, Zaya was the only one on my list that's going to cross over from our last podcast. And by the way, Andrew and I have not compared lists, so we may have some crossover, but I really doubt it. So this one has me at hello, still has me, but I rarely play, and I'll explain why. Doomtown. Now, I know some of you are familiar with Doomtown Reloaded. I'm talking about both Doomtown Reloaded and the original Doomtown. I'm casting back a lot of years ago when a friend of mine was trying to get me into a trading card game, Legends of the Five Rings, that incidentally just got re-released and is a great game. But I was in a friendly local game store, and while I was looking for L5R cards, I saw the Doomtown cards. They hooked me from the outset. This weird West theme that I learned later was part of an RPG, Deadlands, that combined this whole alternate history of the Civil War where the South won and earthquake happened and California broke off and into the ocean, and all this ghost rock started coming out of the ground, this supernatural super fuel, and dead people started coming back alive, and Abraham Lincoln zombie still exists, and it's really just this incredible weird West world that drew me in and sucked me in. And then I played the game, and its combat system, its deck building, for those of you who don't know, Deadlands, or Doomtown, excuse me, has this really interesting mechanic where each card does its thing, but it also has a poker value. And when you do combat, you actually have to lay down a poker hand. So your deck needs to be tuned for the things that it does, plus it has to be tuned for a poker hand. So just the mechanics and the way combat works was so original, so innovative. Everything about that game is utterly amazing, except that it's a game that really requires commitment. And I have a hard time finding a committed group of people who are just going to play Deadlands fairly regularly. In fact, I have a hard time making that, making time for that in my own schedule. Regardless, though, it's still in my collection. Thousands and thousands of original and new Doomtown cards are in my collection, and it stands as the one of the games that I will always love. Hmm. It had me at the very beginning.
Now, I haven't played Doomtown, but I think both you and I are hoping that Grimslingers will provide a similar experience. Maybe not a similar experience mechanically, but I can speak to the fact that when I saw the artwork for Grimslingers, I was hooked in that same Weird West vibe. And perhaps it's not as rich as Doomtown. I don't have any experience with that game, but I'm at least hoping that that campaign and that mechanic will prove to be very fruitful. We'll see.
We will see. One of the things that drove Doomtown was the fact that the cards were pulled out of the Deadlands storylines that were already going on. So you felt story from the very beginning. The flavor text on the cards gave you story. Grimslingers, will have to see how well that world evolves.
Right. I'm really hopeful that the story in that will be good. But that's a rabbit trail.
Yeah.
I've got another game, and if I hadn't met Glory to Rome first, this would probably be my top game, so that's why I'm putting it second. Samurai by Reiner Knizia. I've been a Knizia fan for a long time. I've enjoyed Ra. Recently, I've gotten into Modern Art and some of his other games. I know he has a lot of misses. I know he's very prolific, so there's a lot of chaff with the wheat. But from the moment I saw Samurai just out on a table, from the moment I saw pictures of it with those cool little black figurines that feel like they ought to be ebony, you know they're plastic. I'm talking about the original Rio Grande Games version here. But that game just looks so cool on the table, and I was hooked from the moment I saw that, and I traded for it, and I opened the box, and then I played it, and it is just a deliciously tense abstract with a ton of player interaction. There's I know a lot of people say that Knizia's games are not thematic, and this one especially is not, although I'd make the argument for some of his others, but that's another episode. But what's great about Samurai is that you play the other people in the game. And because you are all congregating around these specific figures that you need to capture, and you're all going for the same figures, and yet you're all contributing to each other's progress by surrounding these figures. So it's very interactive, and it's a rare multiplayer abstract that I can bring out with people because it's so simple to explain, and yet it's got such depth, and that depth is player-driven, which means it will always be original. I've played this one 7 or 8 times already since purchasing it a couple months ago, and I am beyond impressed with it. I do not think it will grow old for me. So this is one where the first impressions have definitely lived up to my expectations.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Andrew and I are on a journey in gaming just like everybody else, but you've been kind of on a Knizia kick lately.
It's true.
And it's not, I think both Andrew and I are pretty, how shall I say it, we're experienced enough to know that just because a designer has one hit, we're not necessarily going to like all of his games.
Right.
But he does have a knack at producing these really interesting abstracts that are so well balanced and really pull you in. Yeah. And in the case of Samurai, even tie into a theme surprisingly well.
Sure.
I was really impressed with it, actually.
No one would call it thematic, but for what the theme is, it matches what you're doing quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll go on the record as saying I think one of his most thematic, if not his most thematic, design is Tigris and Euphrates, where you really get the sense of civilizations rising and falling and political dynasties jockeying for power in this narrow space. It's like 1,200 years of human history compressed into a little hour. And the theme really shines through in this very pure, boiled down abstract mechanics, certainly, and yet you do get a sense of the theme that's very rich.
Yep. Well, another one of those had me at hello games on my list is Smash Up.
Okay.
And Smash Up is going to probably top, always be in my top 10 list. It pulled me in just with its wacky theming. I really just love this idea of sort of, you know, mixing zombies with aliens. And yeah, you know, I was kind of suckered in by that gimmick, if you want to call it a gimmick. But what I wasn't prepared for was how well it would play out. Smash Up gives me all the thrill of all the combat thrill of a game like Android Netrunner or Legends of the Five Rings. Yeah, it's not as complex, I'll give you that. But it gives you that ability to just throw cards out there and do these really sort of powerful combat moves to break these bases, to give other players these really interesting take-that moments. It gives you all of that without all of the overhead of deck building. All you do is just choose characters and go. Oh, yeah, this is kind of a crossover, isn't it?
It is a little bit of a crossover.
Last week's list. Okay, so yeah, this is the last game it'll crossover. But Smash Up had me at hello, and I've bought every single expansion since. Smash Up has never disappointed me. It has never failed me. So I absolutely love it, and that would be my number two on this list.
I appreciate Smash Up. It's solidly within my top 20. I don't see it dropping much farther. I'm not as high on it as you are. I've kind of had a bumpy relationship with it. I really fell for it hard in the beginning, and I bought all the expansions, and then I kind of got to craving the metagame of faction selection, and I saw that all of the factions was a barrier to the people in my game group actually learning the game better. So I actually sold a ton of my factions, and I have two or three of them now, which I think is the sweet spot. And I know we differ on this, but I do agree. Smash Up is a good game. It really grabbed me with that premise of creating wacky. It's a build-your-own theme game, and I really appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
I would just say I'm probably not quite as enthusiastic about it as you are, though it is a good game. I rate it about an 8, I think, on BoardGameGeek, so it's a good one. I've got one that this is a game where I kind of rushed into it. There's very little information about this game. I better not pull a Sam Healy. I better tell you what it is. It is called Kaleika. It is a Polish game put out by the Polish National Institute of History, which is not a place you would normally expect to produce a good game. But surprisingly, it is really good. And I was turned on to this game by Dan Thoreau, who reviews on BoardGameGeek under the name Space Biff. And he is very good at surfacing these more obscure games. And he reviewed this game and said, you know, surprisingly, this historical game, which was designed to teach Polish school children about what life was like under the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, he says, well, this game, which is a historical teaching tool, is actually a really good game also.
Mm.
And the basic premise of the game is that you are Polish citizens trying to line up or queue, which Kolejka is the Polish word for queue. You're trying to queue up behind these different stores so that you can fill a shopping list of 10 items that you need to win the game. And then each round you will flip over some cards and only certain stores will be delivered to that round. And then each of you has a hand of cards where you can manipulate you can either manipulate the lines at the stores, you can move products from one store to maybe a different store where you're first in line. And it just gives you a lot of mess with your neighbor and a lot of just backstabby player interaction mechanics that I really enjoyed. And you know what? Just as crazily, the game is a really good teaching tool as well. You know, I've played it with people who've said, surely things were not like this. And I've said, well, actually, you know, they were like this and still are like this in some parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a really effective teaching tool. They're coming out with a second game about making the border run between East and West Germany. And I've got to try it. Based on Kaleika's reputation, I'm willing to take the plunge into this one. It's by the same designer. I'm really excited about it because Kaleika just merged that historical flavor with a really effective game in a way that really surprised me. It was kind of an impulse. I crafted it. I print and played it. But it was a really solid game. Really enjoyed it.
And see, isn't that interesting? This is one of those games where the input, the kind of the reason it had you at first was you had some background on the game. Maybe if you had just opened the game and played it for the first time without any prior input, but a reviewer you liked recommended it.
Right.
Fascinated with the idea of how closely it was tied in to a historical theme.
Right.
And that gave you the background you needed to be fascinated with it right out of the box.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Or for me, in my case, because it was a print and play, gave me the background I needed to take the time to craft it. I would actually like to craft a second copy of it because I'm not happy with my work. I would like to either purchase the printed game. It did reach publication, though it's kind of hard to find, or craft, you know, a high quality version, because I really think it's a game that deserves a spot in my collection.
Are the print and plays available online?
They are. It's hard to find the links. I actually had to contact the people who published it originally, and they sent me updated links. So wow. I'd have to dig those up again. It didn't get a big splash. I don't think they still sell the published version, although it did get an expansion. You can find it on eBay. You can find it on the Geek Market, people who sell the published version. And then with a little bit of digging, you can find the print and play files. They are available as well.
Well, good. Next one on my list is the complete opposite of a historically themed sort of clever. It is clever, but it's a historically themed, educationally beneficial game. Mine is Devastation of Endings, the Battlecon battle system.
Okay.
Now, this was my first introduction, even though I had seen Yomi and was aware of Fantasy Strike, sort of the David Serlin's, who really kind of developed this whole idea, version of these games that are basically kind of the double blind bluff. People accuse them of being the rock, paper, scissors model, but there is an element of this game where you choose two cards, the other player chooses two cards, you flip at the same time, and you manipulate your character on the battlefield.
Hmm.
This game captures to me the feel of playing a Street Fighter game or any one of these sort of classic player against player video games with special moves and special powers and things that need to be charged up. The game is so rich and so deep. It belongs in a list of games I would like to explore in a different podcast, which is games that you could lose yourself in for a very, very long time. There is so much content in this box. And my son and I enjoy playing this game. And very often we'll hit a character and we'll think, oh, this is so broken. This is so overpowered. But we think, well, wait a minute. Let's try it again. Let's try it again. And, you know, we find that character's weakness and we figure out a way to exploit that. I haven't found two characters that I would say are just completely unbalanced in this game. And especially if you do a draft.
Sure.
You don't really get that. And every single one of the characters comes with its own sort of chips, these sort of in tokens or special abilities that are so different from the other characters, even mechanically, that it's completely asymmetric.
Sure.
So as far as the special powers are concerned. And the only criticism I would level against this game, by the way, is the insert. I know that seems like a strange thing to say. Oh, my goodness. There is so much to keep organized in this game, and the insert was utterly awful. But I went online. Thankfully, on the Geek, somebody had put up these tuck boxes. So right now, everything I have is like organized in these neat tuck boxes. And when you pull off the top of the box, it sort of gives it the effect of like a video game where you're choosing your character.
Okay.
And it is just, that just enhances it. I have not fallen out of love with this game, and it will be a long time, I think, before I do. Devastation of Endings.
I'd be curious to hear what you think of Exceed, which is a kind of a sequel put out by Level 99 Games. I'm not sure if it's David Serlin or not. I'm not familiar with the designer. But I've read that it's a streamlining of Devastation of the Indians, which is easier to get into. So I'd just be curious to hear your thoughts on that. I know that I'm put off by the complexity of games like that. So right. I've looked at Exceed as maybe a more entry-level option.
Yeah, well, it won't be Serlin because Serlin publishes everything under Serlin Games.
Oh, gotcha.
But I am actually backtracking, and I have on order Yomi and Fantasy Strike.
Okay.
And I really would like to do a solid comparison of kind of the best in class of these sort of double blind bluff fighting games.
Okay.
To see where they land against Devastation of Indians.
Well, do you have more on your favorites list? Because that wraps it up for me, at least, those three.
I do have one more, and this is going to be a strange one because I can just hear our listeners falling asleep even as I say the name Puerto Rico. You know, I know it's an older Euro, but at the time that I played Puerto Rico, I had just discovered Euro games.
Okay.
And the fact that they looked kind of bland and themeless, I didn't even care. I was looking for, I had just fallen in love with these low luck, high thinking mechanics. And we pulled out the Puerto Rico game, and I saw that I saw for the first time that character selection mechanic in a game where, okay, this round I'm going to be the mayor and you're going to be the builder. And just the fact that that would drive the play, these roles would drive the play as opposed to the turn order per se, and that you could be a different character every time. And that would influence play in a different way. That just really hooked me. And you added to the fact that I find the game interesting. I like, you know, building all the various helper buildings, building the various farms. And then the biggest thrill, of course, is when you can load up a ship primarily with your goods, especially if you can really mess over the other players by shipping off a ship that has only your goods on it, and you're going to get a whole bunch of VP on it. All of that just really hooked me, and Puerto Rico still remains a favorite to this day. It's one of those games I often wonder, would I be so hooked on it had I not been so enamored with it at the beginning? But it hasn't lost its luster for me. I enjoy the game.
I think that's a game where it has the depth of mechanics that you just keep coming back. I think another example for you, which I have not played, would be Castles of Burgundy or Over Burgundy.
Castles of Burgundy. Burgundy, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's another one where, you know, the mechanics are just that good that it's worth it. It's worth looking past the bland interior to get to the crunchy mechanics inside.
Well, you had me at hello, but now...
Okay.
Games that fall into this category...
I've got a game that headlines this category for me, a game that I quite enjoyed, and now I would say I actively dislike. This is a pretty popular game that a lot of people enjoy. Patchwork by Uwe Rosenberg drives me crazy, and I loved it to start. I loved the simple mechanic. I'd finally found a Rosenberg game that was simple enough for me, and so I bought it. I played it with my wife. We played it over a dozen times, and here's the problem that we found with it. It's quite unbalanced. The patch selection circle that you build around the board that you move throughout, you know, I recognize that you can play that with strategy and you can try to screw your opponent up or, you know, take something that's helpful for you or take something that lets you take a second move because you haven't passed them yet. I understand all of that. And like I said, I've played the game several times, so I feel like we dug into the depth of it. It's still just very random.
Yeah.
And I think broken, it killed the game for us because I could be playing totally fine, playing a great game, and then my wife just comes back and either beats me or lucks into six buttons on two patches or something like that and just totally springs ahead of me. And then, you know, it's a short game, so you don't feel awful about it. It's only about 20 minutes or so. But honestly, I just decided, you know, I'd rather play for a two-player game that I'm going to play with my wife, I'd rather play something else. I have no desire to submit myself to this luck fest. But I really enjoyed the game to begin with, and I just soured on it. The more we played it, the more that became a problem for us. So it wasn't for me.
This is, of course, another topic I think we'll be talking about one day, luck in games. And dice games are often the ones that get hit.
Sure.
You know, take the reputation hit. This game is too lucky. It's too dicey. But this is a perfect example of how a mechanic can be so random. That's exactly what killed the game for me. I learned that the only way I could enjoy that game is if you're playing it with somebody just purely as an activity almost. Sure. And not expecting a strategy payoff to really work, because that circle of pieces,
sure,
is just so random.
Sure.
For me, had me at hello, Small World. Now, again, this...
Oh, you're treading on thin ice, buddy.
This goes back... Small World was one of the first designer board games I got into. And let me tell you why I was so enamored with it, apart from all the really cool factions and races, etc. I was burnt out on games like Risk. But I loved the idea of area control, even though Risk isn't truly area control. It's more expansion on a map, dudes on a map. But I liked the idea of that kind of game without dice. Oh my goodness, it was so refreshing to play this game, and it just, you know, it was just doing the math on who had more armies here, and it was so refreshing. I know you had that little one dice roll at the end, or the one, sure, to three dice, but that doesn't really affect the overall...
That doesn't drive the game. Right.
So, I was just having a great time, and discovered about 6 months later that I just didn't have a lot of desire to play the game. And I'll tell you why. Because of the very thing that drew me to it, deterministic combat, as I learned that it was called.
Right.
Just kind of meant that the battles weren't terribly exciting. And especially as you got to know the game, you could kind of predict, oh yeah, my opponent's going to go into decline here, and he's going to choose the marauding skeletons at this point, and then he's going to come into the map here. It almost became too, I don't know, you could read it too well with players that knew what they were doing. Yeah, and so it sort of lost its luster. I won't turn a game of this down. I still have the game. I haven't purged it from my collection, but it's lost its luster.
Okay, I have to go to bat here. Small World is one of my favorite games. I think what draws me to it is what draws you to Smash Up, and it's the metagame and player negotiation around the game that's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the one thing that I would say, that you have to be negotiating with your players around the table, and you have to be trash talking, you have to be trying to misdirect your true intentions. That is essential to enjoying that game, and that does make it a rather fragile game. I think negotiation games are fragile almost by their nature, because it depends so heavily on which group you're playing it with.
Mm-hmm.
When I break this one out with my buddies, I used to have a Monday night gaming group with some guys, same four of us every week, and Small World hit the table a lot for about 3 months, and it almost became this ongoing thing where what we'd done in the previous games, you know, carried over in grudges to the next game. And it was because we were all such good friends. Now, I don't say that because the mechanics are lousy and you need good friends to prop them up, but if you're playing this just to enjoy the mechanics and just to play it with strangers, perhaps, I do think there's an extra dimension of fun in the game that you won't unlock.
Right.
So I would say that the game can be group dependent. The other thing I would say is that I quickly found the base game map to be very stale, but the Realms expansion, which modularizes the board, saved the game for me. And I usually would not say that an expansion is a must have. I would almost say that with Small World, you've got to try the Realms expansion. It increases setup, but it's worth it because it breaks you out of those patterns that become repetitive, and each scenario introduces, say, one or two new rules, so it keeps the game fresh for you, because you could even play one scenario two or three times say, oh, that's great. Well, let's play the second scenario. I think there's a dozen scenarios in the book. So there's a lot of content there to satisfy you and kind of shake it up and keep it variable.
Well, Realms doesn't add terribly to the setup time of the game. Does it detract that way?
It does add to the setup time of the game. It also adds a sixth player, which will make the game long. Do not play with six. But, you know, if you're going to sit down for an hour, hour and a half with four or five players and play some Small World, I think the setup time is justified. I think the game gives you enough that I'm happy to set it up. It does add to it. I'm not going to lie to you. But I think it's worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I do like the... You bring up a good point that it is more fun with people that you are negotiating with around the table. Hey, yes. Let's work together against this guy. He's clearly in the lead. I love the fact, one of the most genius things about this game was just the fact that the money is one-sided and kept hidden.
Yes.
So you can be just trying to convince your opponents left and right that you're clearly the underdog here, when in fact those coins have a 10 value of each, right, instead of one on them.
Right.
And that does make, that part is fun.
Right. I wish I could go back to our first episode, because I would add Small World to games that I remember specific stories of. Yep. And that makes it, actually, I had decided earlier in my gaming progress that I should dislike Small World, that it was not a good game, that I really needed to find a better area control. And then I just started thinking about all the stories that I've had with it and all the fun that I've had with it. And I realized, you know, despite me deciding that I need to dislike this game, I actually really like this game. So I've made my peace with it, I think, for what it is. It's a phenomenal game. It's one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. Like Smash Up, I think it lands in the top 20 thereabouts. It's a favorite. I don't see myself ever getting rid of it. Now, one game that I would have said that about, that I now no longer own, that I've gotten rid of, Five Tribes. And I include this game...
You surprised me with this one, by the way.
I include this game not because I dislike it even, but just because I used to rank it so highly, and now I don't own it. So what happened? Like, what? Why the fall from grace? That's why I include it. I would still say it's a good game. I would still play it and enjoy it, but I don't feel a need to own it. And here's why. You know, for all I love that game, there's only a certain type of person who can easily see that board and yes, see that layout and the strategy. And there just weren't those people in my group. And so the game never got played. And when it did get played, it was people who were trying to figure out, now let's see, where do I move? And I know a lot of people have knocked this game for analysis paralysis. And I will say, if you're playing with the wrong people, you'll get analysis paralysis. There are certain types of people. I think I'm one of them. I just see the moves intuitively. I just see what you have to do.
I've never understood that complaint for me personally, but you're right. I've played with people who, for them, it's overwhelming.
Right.
But for me, it's sort of like, no, clearly. I mean, you look for those clusters where you're going to get the most value. Clearly, that's the better move right now.
Right, exactly.
It doesn't take me very long to make decisions on that game at all. But why the fall from grace then? Because you couldn't find players to play it with you?
Because I couldn't find players to play it with me. And for me personally, if a game is not getting played, unless it's something truly special, I can't make an exception for it and keep it in my collection.
Yeah.
I mean, there's only a couple games that I will keep because they're great. Sid Sackson's Acquire would be one example. You know, I know I'm not going to get that one played very often, but that is such a classic of gaming that I have to keep it. And Five Tribes just wasn't that for me.
And this is going to underscore a difference that you guys will hear about very often in our podcasts. Andrew and I have a very different approach
sure.
to our collections.
Absolutely.
I just don't like throwing things away. I'm the hoarder. And so I have 300 plus games in my collection, and there are many I know I should purge, but I think, well, I just need to get back to that and give it another shot. Andrew is a lot more, I'm going to say, disciplined, and I respect that about you. And I think you just look, is this game getting played?
Yeah.
are there other games that are doing this thing better? Do I really need this particular one in my collection? And right. you purge it. So you can be harder on a game than I would be. I would tend to make room for both in my collection where you might get rid of one of those.
Well, I would say that just because I don't own a game doesn't mean I don't think it's a good game. True. I mean, I would still put Five Tribes at a 7 or an 8. I still think it's a good game. Like I said, I'd still play it. I feel like I can see that puzzle nicely, and I enjoy it. The expansion adds to my enjoyment. It's great. But if I can't get that played with my Saturday game group or, you know, with some of the other people that I play with, then there's no point for me personally to keep it.
You are compulsive about games. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are board game geeks. It is a hobby of ours. We're a little bit obsessed with.
Sure.
You, however, your obsession does not drive you to keep a triple digit collection.
Sure.
You're constantly on the search for, I would say, not just new and interesting things. It's another thing you'll find about Andrew that I respect about him as a gamer. He's always dips back into the past.
Because, what else is on your list?
Yeah. So, Escape. The first 2-3 games of Escape that I ever played were among the most memorable gaming experiences I have ever had. It was astounding to play this cooperative, real-time, with a soundtrack running and the tension, and I still enjoy this game. But after multiple plays of it, I have found that it just doesn't get asked for a lot. And I don't know why that is. I think it's because maybe it's the kind of thing where once you've done it a few times and once you've beat it a few times, it's sort of like, well, what's the point of revisiting it? There's something in there that doesn't just really grab me in terms of replayability. Some of the expansions kind of added some complexity, but they weren't the kind of complexity I was interested in. I'm really not interested in making the game harder by drawing a curse card that makes me put my hand on top of my head. Okay, I get it. It's funny. It makes people laugh. It's a cool story. And it was the first few times we played it. But then it just kind of got old. And I still have Escape. I won't turn down a game of Escape. But I've played other real-time co-ops since. I think Space Alert is far more interesting to me as a real-time co-op. It's far more heady in terms of its programming mechanic that's in it. It's also just very unforgiving. And the goal in that game is not to bring a pristine ship home. That'll never happen. It's just sort of to barely limp home alive. And that, I don't know, games like that just seem to have a little more draw to me than Escape.
I can't help it. You're taking pot shots at some of my favorite games. So I've got to go to bat for this one. And first, let me say that I agree with you. I do not get this one played in my game group. Now, if you've been listening for the past 20 minutes, you may say, well, you probably don't own it anymore. You probably got rid of it because you're a ruthless, efficient purger who hates fun and enjoyment. That's not entirely true. But again, this game is audience specific. And this is our most played game, partially because it's so easy to knock out in 10 minutes, but then also to play 3 or 4 times in one sitting. This is a game that I play exclusively 2-player with Alicia, which is odd.
Really?
It doesn't seem like her type of game. She absolutely loves it. She tends towards co-ops, and every so often she'll just look at me and say, let's play some Escape. And we are both familiar with the game, so we ramp up the difficulty. We add more gems than you're supposed to. We add the quests. I highly recommend the quests if you want replayability in this game, because you shuffle in 1 to 3 random quests, and you never know quite what you're going to get. Some of them are a lot harder than others. Some of them are easier. So you just kind of never know what hand you've been dealt until you start discovering the temple. And this game bogs down with new players. You know, it's a snooze fest if you've played it and you have to teach a new person, because they're, you know, grappling with the basic mechanic. Alicia and I are having conversations about, oh, did you put the laundry in? Did you, you know, fold those clothes, while we're playing the base game, because it's just so boring. I mean, I can do it in my sleep. But when we play 2-player and when we ramp the difficulty up and when we try and we fail and we try again and we fail and then we finally succeed, and that's just really good quality time with her. Yeah. So I will go to bat for that game, but I will also acknowledge that there's a lot there. That's a very specific niche, and it just happens to be one that works for me.
I don't think I've ever pursued play of that game in that way. In other words, find one expert, right, ramp it up to its highest difficulty, and right, just go for it as a right, two-player game like that. It's always been kind of a larger group experience, and again, it's inevitably been with those groups, oh, we loved it the first few times, but let's do something else now.
Right.
So, what else on your list?
Well, I've got a couple others, none that hit me so extremely that I feel the need to really, you know, talk at length about them. Lewis and Clark is a crunchy Euro that I enjoyed and just never really was amazing for me. Mm. So I ended up getting rid of it. But again, it wasn't something that I was super pumped about. I got a good first impression of it. I enjoyed it the first few plays, and then I just kind of got tired of it. Paperback is a game that I really got excited about at the beginning.
That, if I thought about it, might have hit my list.
I love the potential in that game, but you know what? The game is just unfinished. It's just not tuned. What I want is a game that is a deck builder where someone who's not a gamer can focus on the word creation aspect and still do well, whereas I can focus on the deck building aspect, and we both have an even shot at winning. But and maybe that's not what the game is intended to be. But I remember one specific play that left such a sour taste in my mouth. I was playing with Alicia, two player, and she was beating me. She was building great words. She was focusing on card acquisition. She had a better deck than I did, objectively. But then I had purchased the double word score card.
Yeah,
that one card gives me so many problems. Maybe we should try playing without it. I purchased the double word score card. I bought the most expensive point card there was, and I ended the game. And even though she had the better engine, even though she'd put in the time to build a better deck, I beat her. And she hated that so much that it just soured the game for both of us.
You know, you just kind of triggered something that I'm going to rant just slightly about, which is what I can't stand is when somebody says, well, if you don't like this about the game, just sort of house rule this or house rule that. I just can't stand a game, and I think this is in that category for me. The only reason why it's in my collection is that my wife still loves this game, but I don't like the fact that it's over too soon. I don't like the fact that it sort of teases you into trying to build an engine that you can never really quite get going before the game ends.
Sure.
I don't like the fact that it sort of just mimicked Dominion, I think, way too closely and should have been a little bit more innovative in its mechanics. And there is a lot that could be house-ruled, quote-unquote, to try to make this game better, but I shouldn't have to do that.
Yeah, you shouldn't have. A great game does not need house rules, and a mediocre game isn't worth my time to house rule, because there's plenty of great games out there, so why play the mediocre game or put in the effort to finish the designer's work?
And I want to be careful, because I think Fowers is a good designer.
Absolutely. I really enjoy some of the stuff he
does. I'm not saying that he's not. I just think that this screams for a revised edition with updated rules.
I'm really eager. I'm really eager to try hardback. I think that's what it's called, hardback. He's been careful to say that it's very different from paperback, and from what I've seen of it, it looks like maybe on the second go round, he changed how wilds work. He gives you more flexibility in word building, and instead of the Dominion style work, what you have is the Ascension style, or not Ascension, pardon me. The Star Realm style factions, where you have four genres of cards and you buy them and you kind of pair them together. But it looks like it's a more forgiving game in the word creation. So I think that would address my main criticism with paperback.
You know, I'm going to bring up another game that was a recent one, because a lot of these that I brought up, these are back in the day when I was first getting into gaming, and I think the effect was better. There was something about, and I watched the No Pun Included, which, by the way, love No Pun Included. You guys are doing great work.
Absolutely.
Shout out to you guys. We really appreciate your reviews. And I did appreciate your review of Guilds of London. It hooked me. And I know that you pointed out some challenges or issues or problems with the game, but you didn't really kill it for me. It was a game I so much wanted to like, and I loved the idea of these little guilds and hiring these livermen and these tense decisions of oh, should I try to have the majority livery man on this guild and get this ability, or this guild and that get that ability or that benefit? But in the end, the problem I had with that game was one of its core mechanics, which is you have to have the color card to move that particular liveryman to that particular color guild. Hmm. And it limited play so much because you didn't always have that card. So you would find yourself in these situations where, oh yeah, to hire liveryman, you can just burn any card and boom, you've hired a liveryman. But to move him, you have to have that particular color card. Hmm. And Andrew, when you and I have played this game, and I know you're a lot more forgiving of it than I am, I've felt that tension, both on your side and on my side. I can't do anything. Right. There's clearly an obvious move out here, but I just can't pursue it because I don't have the card that moves the guy. And that just killed it for me.
I only played this game once, so I can't really draw a final conclusion on it. I've only played it once.
Oh.
I liked it more than you did, I think, overall. Again, I haven't explored the depth there. I think it's the same limitation that you dislike about Kingdom Builder that I find intriguing. It's that it's the game forcing you to find the optimal move when the obvious move, sure, maybe you can't do. But now what are you going to do when your cards are bad? What move are you going to make then? That's what I find intriguing about it. And so I wasn't bothered by that restriction. It felt like that was the game to me. You know, that very restrictive game space was the challenge. So I enjoyed it. I'd like to try it again. It could be after I've played four or five times. I agree with you. Yeah, the colors are way too restricting. I can't do what I need to do. It's just frustrating. Right. But if it's just enough that it's intriguing and challenging and not frustrating, I think it can be a successful mechanic. And it's probably just a difference in taste between you and me. I don't know.
This I think actually would rank number one in this very distinct category of games whose mechanics are absolutely perfect, except for one fatal flaw. If we were to do a list of that, this would be that for me. That's how much I like the rest of this game.
Okay.
And those listening, maybe you won't find this to be a fatal flaw. Maybe sure. Maybe you'll enjoy that aspect of the game, but it just killed it for me.
All right. Well, I think that wraps up our two questions. So this has been just a little dive into first impressions in games and some of the questions that we ask ourselves as we kind of explore new games and games that we're interested in. Next week, we're going to be looking at board game criticism and kind of wrestling with some questions around reviewing board games, something that we think could use a little more attention these days. And as we look at getting into board game reviews ourselves, beyond this podcast, these are questions that we're asking. So be sure to tune in next week for that.
So thanks for listening to Get On Board. I'm Tim. By the way, I'm Board Game Greek on Board Game Geek.
I'm Andrew. I do not have a creative username, but you can find me easily under Andrew Joyce. And you can find Get On Board on iTunes, SoundCloud, Board Game Geek, and the web. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.